This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Donald Trump has boasted of winning the presidency with a far smaller campaign budget than Hillary Clinton, relying largely on social media. A social media consulting firm closely linked to the campaign is now giving many people cause for deep concern. Cambridge Analytica recruited Facebook users to take a survey and then quietly harvested their data and data on their friends. A company whistleblower, Christopher Wiley, told The Guardian his former bosses gathered info on more than 50 million users, enough to profile the whole country.
You are playing with an entire country, the psychology of an entire country, without their consent or awareness. And not only are you, like, playing with the psychology of an entire nation, you're playing with the psychology of an entire nation in the context of the democratic process.
An expose by a British newscast also shows Cambridge executives detailing their dirtier tricks to what they thought was a potential customer, including brainstorming ways to generate blackmail material. Now, Facebook says it has suspended Cambridge Analytica and that its app did not constitute a data breach. And as far as we know, that's true. None of these profiles was apparently stolen. But something else has been breached at Facebook. Trust. And more lawmakers around the world are saying their trust is all but gone. How can we hold Facebook and companies like Cambridge Analytica to account? Is it time to delete our profiles for good? Or is there a better way to demand change? We'll dive into all that and more today, and we'll ask a data firm that worked for the Obama campaign how it helped the former president win. Stay close.
Hello, just dropping in to remind you about Here and Now. We cover the day's most essential news with context so you know the why and what's next. A fast-paced snapshot of the world every day. Listen to Here and Now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Joining us from NPR in New York is Izzy Lepowski, senior writer for Wired magazine. She's been covering this story and has spoken to Cambridge Analytica's CEO. Izzy, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, can we define just clearly what exactly Cambridge Analytica is? It's a data analysis firm. I get that. They scrub through Facebook data. I get that. But can you define the company a little more, maybe the way the company would define itself?
Sure. Cambridge Analytica is a U.S.-based company that spun out of a British company called SCL. And they are, you know, an ad targeting firm, but their big marketing pitch to their clients has been that we're different because instead of doing demographic targeting, we do something called psychographic targeting. And what that means is instead of just focusing on things like gender, age range, region, they are trying to decipher people's personalities. Are you conscientious? Are you open? Are you neurotic? And, you know, those methods have been called into question as to whether or not they're really effective. But the bigger question has been, well, how do they know these things? And, you know, I've spoken with them in the past and their rationale has always been, well, we purchase commercially available data, we conduct surveys, and then we use that survey data to sort of extrapolate ideas about the rest of the electorate. But what we're obviously finding out is that this was also based on a deep well of information from Facebook. In 2014, this company commissioned this third-party researcher to conduct a large-scale psychological profiling of the United States, and he did so using that app.
Before we go deeper into what Cambridge did, how unusual are companies like Cambridge Analytica or the kind of psychographic research that they did?
You know, psychographic research is, some people accuse it of being snake oil. So I would say there aren't a lot of these firms actually practicing it. Actually, Dr. Alexander Kogan, the researcher who was working with Cambridge, says himself that they found that the psychographic profiles are six times more likely to be inaccurate than accurate. But just because psychographic profiling isn't necessarily as, you know, prevalent, data mining certainly is. I mean, that's Facebook's entire business model,
right?
And it's Google's too, to sell off people's data. And this is, you know, I don't know how many billions of dollars in this industry. But it's certainly not Cambridge Analytica alone that is, you know, taking this data from Facebook, from Google, from Twitter, from anybody who will sell it, really, and trying to use it to sell them products and in some cases to sell them political parties.
Tell us exactly how this data mining worked and what they did with the data once they had it.
Sure. So Alexander Kogan, who is this University of Cambridge researcher, he developed an app called This Is Your Digital Life. And it basically, you know, presented itself as a fun kind of quiz that Facebook users could take to predict their personality type. So people did this, you know, willingly. They opted in. 270,000 Facebook users it was. And in doing so, they, you know, answered a bunch of questions and maybe without realizing it, were handing over all their personal data from Facebook, things they like, pages they follow, but critically also that same information about their friend network. And this is because up until about, you know, mid 2015, Facebook allowed app developers to not only take data from the people who willingly opt into the app, but also their entire friend network. They called it the Social Graph API. And that's a really powerful thing because you see in Cambridge's case, they went from 270,000 people opting in to a full spectrum of 50 million users. Facebook, you know, shut down that capability in 2015 because obviously, you know, why would that ever be possible? This is 50 million users who never knew that they were being that their data was being bought and sold by this researcher. So Dr. Kogan passed this information on to Cambridge Analytica, and Cambridge Analytica then takes that information on 50 million users and sees what it can get from it. And it uses that to build these personality profiles. And once you have personality profiles on, say, 30 million Americans, you can sort of detect patterns. You know, if somebody likes this sorts of pages, or if somebody, they also, you know, have commercial data that doesn't come from Facebook about what people buy, and they merge that all together to create a picture of who you are.
Right.
And that informed, they created scores. You know, how do you rank on something like gun rights, things like that. And so they use these scores to basically target ads to people.
Raymond writes on our Facebook page, Facebook was designed to scrape data and marketing info. If people would read license agreements instead of skipping them, they should know this. All apps collect your data and you gave them permission to. There was and is nothing covert about this process. Nothing on Facebook is private except payment information. You have a public profile, but also you have a problem if someone uses the information you posted for the world to see. Izzy, I think Raymond's comment kind of gets at the heart of this issue. I mean, I kind of disagree with him saying that there was nothing covert about the process. The fact that people who didn't know about the app got their data scraped, that feels kind of covert. But I do understand Raymond's point. This is exactly what Facebook was designed to do. And Cambridge Analytica used the system as intended in a way.
Absolutely. And it's not just Facebook, right? I mean, you hear people saying boycott Facebook, and I understand their anger, but then you have to boycott YouTube, boycott Gmail, boycott Twitter, boycott, frankly, you know, buying things with a credit card because the credit card companies are selling your purchase data to major data packagers. So this is the way that the internet was designed to work. I've said this before, but we really are the product on the internet. I know we think we're getting the service, but we're getting the service for free because they're selling right. our information. And so you're right. This is exactly how Facebook was meant to work. But I think that it's very fair to question whether that's the way we're okay with it working, right? Facebook has made changes in the past. It did shut down this Social Graph API that allowed people to scoop up data about your friend networks. I think that was a really important change because why would that capability ever exist? And, you know, he mentions that, you know, all of this is spelled out clearly. Clearly, in their terms of service and their licensing, sure, if you want to go read 50 to 100 pages of legalese every time you download an app, go for it. But I don't know that that's the fairest way to inform the public about how their data is being used. And in fact, in the EU, they're changing their laws around this, requiring more explicit affirmative confirmation, not just having people click a I accept all terms and who knows what's in the terms.
What about the fallout at Facebook itself? So far, the company's stock has fallen fairly sharply. What other fallout has there been early on?
Yeah, this is a major crisis for them. I know that it's been reported that they're having, you know, an all-hands meeting today to discuss this and questions around Cambridge. There's been some reporting that the head of security, Alex Stamos, is stepping down. He's been one of the sort of defenders out front on this. Facebook apparently went to SCL yesterday, which is the parent company to Cambridge Analytica to conduct their own audit, and they were told to stand down by the UK's information commissioner because, you know, regulators are saying, we didn't really like the way you guys handled this before. I think we'd like to do this our way. So they're definitely realizing that this is different from other times that, you know, they've been in hot water over how they deal with people's privacy, because this is not just sort of a you know, loose idea. People are realizing that this actually can have an influence on elections and on democracy.
Izzy, one other thing I wanted to ask you about was this expose that was released yesterday by Channel 4 News in the UK. It was an undercover expose targeting Cambridge Analytica. Here's a clip from it. This is the CEO of the company, Alexander Nix, speaking to an undercover investigative reporter who he believes is a politician from Sri Lanka who might be interested in paying for their services.
Deep digging is interesting, but, equally effective can be just to go and speak to the incumbents and to offer them a deal that's too good to be true. Make sure that that's video recorded. You know, these sorts of tactics are very effective. Instantly having video evidence of corruption, putting it on the internet.
That was the CEO of Cambridge Analytica, Alexander Nix, as heard on an expose that aired yesterday from Channel 4 News in the UK. Izzy, these are some pretty dirty tricks that this company is offering to help their would-be client engage in. What's the fallout been like for Cambridge Analytica in the last few days?
Yeah, that video was really remarkable. I've been reporting on Cambridge for the last 3 years, and I've been hearing, you know, rumors about, you know, those kinds of tactics, and I always sort of wrote it off as conspiratorial. And here it is coming straight from the CEO's mouth, sort of the worst of what people say about this company. And what I've been hearing is that, you know, it's just a crisis lockdown at Cambridge Analytica. They are trying to figure out what to do. These are, you know, the leadership of this company. It's Alexander Nix. It's also their chief of data. It's their chief of political. So these are, you know, the highest of the high at the company. And they, you know, from what I can tell, you know, former employees of the company say that, you know, this is not the company we thought we were working for. This couldn't be even farther removed from the work we felt we were doing on a day-to-day basis. So there's a little uncertainty over whether this was, you know, bluster on Alexander Nix's part. Was he saying anything to clinch the deal? And of course, in his response to this, he did say, you know, he was saying all of these things in an effort to, you know, humor and not embarrass the would-be client. But they're pretty extreme claims to be making just in the service of humoring someone. I think that, you know, you might see some personnel changes at Cambridge. That's unclear. But certainly being cut off from Facebook is a major hit to them for any advertiser. Facebook is just a huge, it's you know, a huge percentage of your ad budget for digital ads. So that is, you know, it would be hard to survive that alone, separating the reputational damage that's been done from this video and from the other scandal.
Let's keep going and add a few more voices to our conversation. Joining us here in studio is Brendan Fisher of the Campaign Legal Center. He's the director of its efforts on reforming of the Federal Election Commission. The center filed a complaint with the commission about Cambridge Analytica 2 years ago. Also joining us from Syracuse University in New York is Jen Greigel, an assistant professor at the S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications, where she specializes in social media and data analytics. Jennifer Greigel, let me come to you if we've got you on the line. I wonder how surprised you were, if at all, to hear about what happened with Cambridge Analytica. I mean, is this truly an unusual case, or is Cambridge Analytica just the first one that got caught?
Well, I think we, as a country, really got a wake-up call post-election here in the United States. First with kind of hearing about the Russian government being able to place political ads, but then getting a better understanding of how some of the companies, such as Cambridge Analytica, have been using Facebook data to also influence our election. And now we are seeing that some of the information and data that they had gathered on our users was essentially collected in, it sounds like, unethical ways, as Facebook is now claiming that they have captured this data and taken it, and it was in violation of the user agreement. So I think it's a wake-up call, but we're just starting to get some more insight into the risks of data privacy, especially in the internet age, and starting to see how these social media companies really have had a thin veil of regulation and oversight to date, and we really need our government regulators to step it up.
Chris in East Peoria, Illinois writes, when Facebook started, it seemed to be a young person's or young adult's app. Nowadays, my grandma's got a Facebook account, as well as my mom and most baby boomers in my family. Would it have been as useful if Facebook had been breached prior to the baby boomer surge on Facebook? Izzy Lepowski, I wonder if you can take this question about just the maybe the critical mass that Facebook has reached to the point where it really is, with the rise of baby boomer members, a pretty good demographic reach of the country.
Sure. Well, any store of data is going to be valuable, right? If Facebook were still just a college platform like it was when I joined it, it would still be valuable to some marketers. But now you're talking about you have 2 billion plus people on Facebook. It's more powerful than any platform we've ever seen in history in terms of its data collection. It's just an incredibly massive weapon if used improperly. And that's why, you know, I think a lot of the risks associated with that sort of snuck up on people, right? Because it was sort of this service just to catch up with old friends from high school and to look at, you know, friends' baby photos and things like that. It gradually shifted more and more toward being a vehicle for news. And we've seen how divisive that can be because it ends up feeding us more and more news that we already agree with and sort of forcing us into these little bubbles. And we saw how that played out during the 2016 election. And I think Jennifer is absolutely right. Seeing how now the ad side, the data side can be abused really was a wake-up call. So I think no matter what, it would have been valuable. But with 2 billion people on the platform, you really can't compare it to anything else.
We heard from a number of you why you are or are not on Facebook. Here are 2 responses that came to our inbox.
Hi, I'm Meredith. I live in Michigan.
My name is Vlad, and I'm from Marietta, Georgia.
I recently, in the past 6 months, deleted my Facebook account.
I haven't been on Facebook since I was about 16, 17.
I am completely disgusted with the lack of responsibility that Facebook has shown.
Now I see my friends who are constantly engaged in social media and how much information they're giving away willingly.
I am not going to let them sell my personal data.
Their location, who they're with, where they've just been. It's ridiculous.
What I don't understand is why organizations such as yours, 1A, still has a Facebook page. What is up with that?
Hey there, thanks for calling in, and I do understand where you're coming from with that, but Jen, I think the reason that 1A has a Facebook page is because just about everyone else does too. I mean, the world has changed in such a way that if you want to reach the largest, most easily targeted critical mass of people, you do it on Facebook.
It's where a lot of people are now. I've been referring to it as Facebook inertia. We've really been pulled into this together. A lot of people don't have the option to just boycott the platform or to disconnect. That's where we're connected with our friends and family, and that's where people are able to reach us. The challenge is getting this into a place where it's safer for us and where our privacy is protected on these platforms. That's the real challenge.
Brendan, what about the law? I mean, Facebook boycotting is kind of a mixed bag. Some people have suggested that you can. Some people have suggested that it's not possible. Facebook itself has said that when it puts out a straw poll, if 10% of the user base agrees with it, then it will go along with it. It doesn't require a simple majority. 10% of Facebook's user base is 200 million people. So, there's that. I wonder what you, in your view from the Campaign Legal Center, think about the way that the government is dealing with Facebook in its regulatory capacity with the Federal Trade Commission and in terms of the laws. I get the sense we're still playing catch-up as a country.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think Facebook has had bipartisan support for a long time for Facebook's efforts to not have any regulations applied to it whatsoever. But I think it's also important to talk about the laws as they apply to Cambridge Analytica, because there's been a lot of questions raised about this in the last couple of days. One, everybody is focused on Russia collusion, and there are questions about the role that Cambridge Analytica might play in the Mueller investigation. And we don't have enough evidence of this yet. We know that Cambridge Analytica representatives met three times in 2014 and 2015 with oil executives for the Russian oil firm Lukoil. We know that Alexander Nix, the CEO of Cambridge Analytica, reached out to WikiLeaks in 2016 to try and obtain the hacked Clinton emails. And we certainly know from the Channel 4 investigation that was published yesterday that Cambridge Analytica is certainly willing to do anything it takes to win elections. But we don't know what role Cambridge Analytica might play in this broader Russia collusion investigation. But even setting aside these questions of foreigners, we think that there is potential for domestic campaign finance violations. And we've actually been looking at Cambridge Analytica since back in 2016. I think there's only been passing reference made to Robert Mercer. Robert Mercer is the owner of Cambridge Analytica, and he is also the single biggest Trump backer in the 2016 elections.
Economically speaking,
Robert Mercer spent the most money financially supporting Trump in the 2016 elections. And he founded and his daughter ran a super PAC called Make America Number One. And the law is clear that super PACs and campaigns are supposed to be independent of one another, but all indications were that the Trump campaign and this Mercer super PAC, Make America Number One, were intertwined. We know that the Mercer suggested that Trump hire Steve Bannon to head his campaign. We also know that they suggested that he hire Kellyanne Conway. And the Mercers also suggested that Trump hire Cambridge Analytica to run data for the Trump campaign. And this would appear to violate the FEC common vendor rule, which is designed to preserve the independence of super PACs and campaigns. And we filed an FEC complaint about that in 2016.
Lest we think that this rests too much on the Trump campaign, we should note that he's not the first to do this. The use of social media to great effect is something that Donald Trump has in common with Barack Obama. We will learn more about how President Obama did it just ahead.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from GoToMeeting. It's the simple, flexible, collaborative meeting tool that works for you so you can focus on getting work done. Trusted by 18 million monthly users, GoToMeeting lets you connect on the go from any device so you can move work forward from anywhere in the world. To learn how your company can make the switch today, visit GoToMeeting.com.
Hello, just dropping in to remind you about On Point, the NPR show where we take you behind the headlines. On Point talks with newsmakers and real people about issues that matter most. Listen to On Point now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Richard tweeted, "This is such a distraction. They all do this. This is how social media works. Cambridge Analytica is not the only one. The Obama campaign took not just 50 million profiles, but every American user of Facebook. That's the purpose of social media." That is a great point to put to our next guest, who did work on building the data analytics for the Obama campaign. Michael Simon joins us from NPR in New York. He's the co-founder and CEO of the tech company Elucid. Michael, welcome to 1A.
Hello there. Happy to be here.
How did you build the data analytics system for the Obama campaign? Is it basically what Cambridge Analytica did, or were there some key differences?
There are some key differences. Ultimately, what the Obama campaign was trying to build, and what now has sort of become stock in trade for any political campaign, you know, I would say, from what's called a statewide campaign on up on either side of the aisle, is building a database of the entire electorate. And trying to predict, and by the way, that data is publicly available. That comes from voter files. This is government data that any political party or candidate can get access to. Has information like name and address and what elections you voted in, et cetera. Then the campaigns seek to augment that data with data that is unique to them and gives them an electoral advantage. So in the case of the Obama campaign, we were trying to predict how likely every American, or at least every American in the swing state, was not only to vote for Barack Obama, so were they someone who was on the table that we could potentially persuade, or were they someone that essentially was never going to vote for us no matter what we do, how likely they were to vote, which of course is really important. Again, are you trying to persuade someone to vote for you, or are you trying to persuade someone who is already inclined to vote for you to vote, period? which was a lot of the challenge of the Obama campaign. And then, of course, the third and very important question is, what can I do to get this person how can I persuade them to vote for me? What issues move them? Should I be talking to them about health care? Should I be talking about education, et cetera, et cetera? So the Obama campaign built this large database, again, based off of publicly available government data, augmented with a lot of survey data. So we went out and did hundreds of thousands of, traditional, call someone on the phone, ask them their opinion on a variety of political subjects.
And Michael, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to make sure we're clear. When you say survey, you're not talking about the kind of survey app that Cambridge Analytica uses. You're talking about an old-fashioned, hi, this is Joshua. I'm calling from Survey USA. Can I talk to you about your vote? Like an old-fashioned survey.
You're completely correct. Gotcha. That's right. And so that information, you call someone on the phone. You would ask them, their responses to survey questions. And then you would take that information and you would append it back to this massive, voter file built off of, again, government data. And then you would take the, several hundred thousand responses that you got, and you would use, standard statistical modeling techniques to project how people who had not answered the survey questions might respond to them.
We got a number of comments from listeners who were concerned about the nature of the use of this data across political campaigns, including this voicemail, which was left in our inbox.
This is Phil from Michigan. In 2013, Barack Obama used data mining to get voters for his election, and there were no less than 15 articles praising him on how smart he was and how he was a genius, smartest man in the room. And in 2018, Donald Trump did the same thing. And there's more than 15 articles saying how big of a criminal he is, and this needs to be investigated, and this is the biggest travesty in the world. And what does it all mean? It just means that fake news is prevalent, and nobody believes the news anymore because it's only pushing their own agenda, and they're lying to the American people.
Michael, I do take Phil's point. What about that? We did regard the Obama campaign as a groundbreaker for its ability to use social media. Isn't it just the same thing in a different form?
Well, it's a fair question, phrased somewhat unfairly. And I think that's why I wanted to really articulate the way that we did what we did, because it was very transparent.
So where did you use the Facebook data? How did that come in?
Well, okay, so the core difference between what the Obama campaign did and what Cambridge Analytica did here revolves around consent and transparency. So Cambridge Analytica hired a academic third-party intermediary that paid Facebook users between $1 and $2 to install a Facebook app that essentially was malware. It served the sole purpose of scraping the Facebook pages of the users who installed it, as well as their entire Facebook graph. And so that data was then, hoovered up by Cambridge Analytica's partner, sold to Cambridge Analytica, and used by them to build these statistical models, in contrast to, the way the Obama campaign went and gathered its data. Some users, some listeners have made reference to the Obama campaign's use of their own Facebook app. It asked for access to the user's own basic information, as well as the email address, and then basic information about the Facebook friends of an Obama volunteer who was installing this app that, again, was branded with the Obama campaign, that was very clear about its intent. And the intent was to allow me, a Facebook volunteer, to figure out which of my friends lived in battleground states and hadn't voted yet. And then to be able to contact them and say, hey, Joshua, I see, you live in Virginia. It's a battleground state. It's really important. You haven't voted yet. Let me as an Obama volunteer remind you to vote. So I think the difference here was the intent and the transparency and the disclosure.
Let me bring a few of our panelists back in on this, particularly Brendan Fisher. I'd like your take on what Michael just described and the comparison between that and Cambridge Analytica. Do you think that satisfies Phil from Michigan's concern about this being kind of the same kind of marketing, but just with different candidates, or were they fundamentally different?
Yeah, well, I think the point he raises is an important one, and it's important that we not view this as a partisan issue. The loopholes in digital regulation can be used and misused by political operatives in any party. And an important part of this conversation that's not unique to to Cambridge Analytica is the role of micro-targeting and the fact that micro-targeted ads are only viewable by the individuals to whom those ads are targeted. They're not otherwise publicly available. And Cambridge Analytica was very explicit about their use of negative messaging and their use of fear to motivate certain voters or to deter other voters from voting at all. And it's a cynical strategy, and that may not be entirely new in U.S. politics. You could say that LBJ's Daisy ad played into people's fear of nuclear war. The first Bush's Willie Horton ad used dog whistle politics and fear of crime to win elections. But the difference with digital ads is that the ads themselves are kept secret. So when the first Bush ran that Willie Horton ad, there was the opportunity for a public debate. There was the opportunity to challenge Bush on using dog whistle politics to win elections. And that's not the case when ads are micro-targeted and only viewable by the individuals to whom those ads are targeted.
Jennifer, we have not really heard from any of Facebook's main executives since this scandal broke.
Right. Well, they've sent their legal counsel to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee around the Russia advertising incident. But we really need executive leadership here to come and tell us exactly what's happening. We need Mark Zuckerberg, especially given that he, you know, is running the largest social media company on the planet. And that isn't just Facebook. It's Facebook, it's Instagram, it's WhatsApp, and it's also Facebook Messenger. He literally has most of the social media market under his control. We need him to come and be accountable. But as the other viewer and listener just mentioned, fake news, we have to consider how social media companies and platforms are influencing the role that journalism used to play as the fourth estate, as a watchdog. There are so many things that we need to hear from these social media companies on, and I really think they need to show up and testify. We need to get real answers and hold them accountable for what's happened here.
Aaron writes, I recently saw someone post information about how to properly delete a Facebook page. Apparently, you can't just delete your account and everything's gone off the internet. The process involves going into your activity log on Facebook and deleting each individual post, like, photo, etc., one by one. A daunting task if someone is very active on their account. Izzy, before we're out of time, what do you see as the next step in all of this? I don't know if a Facebook boycott will coalesce, but is there any way that users can actually influence this, or are we kind of at the mercy of the company and governments?
Well, I think their users have power in terms of trying to influence their elected officials. You have people like Senator Klobuchar, people like Senator Warner, and others who are starting to become aware of the problems this poses. So I think that, people can have some influence there. I don't think deleting your account one by one is going to make a difference, because remember, Facebook is a global company, and not everybody around the world is as riled up about what happened in the 2016 election as Americans maybe are. One very clarifying point I wanted to make, though, was that, you know, a lot of this has centered around the impact this had on the 2016 election. According to, you know, everything we've heard from the Trump campaign, from my own reporting, the Trump campaign was really focused on using data from the Republican National Committee. And they did have Cambridge Analytica employees working in the office. But from my understanding is that those Cambridge Analytica employees were really crunching the RNC's data. That doesn't necessarily mean that this data that Cambridge had wasn't used at all, because that company was also working for Ted Cruz and they had worked for Ben Carson. Mm-hmm. But I think that's an important point to make, because a lot of times people just want to keep boiling this down to the 2016 election. I think we really need to broaden our sights here and say this is a much bigger data privacy issue. You know, Michael was talking about the disclosures that the Obama campaign had, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in 2012, the Obama campaign was also able to get access to the entire social graph. So not just the people who opted into those permissions, but also their friend networks, because Facebook didn't eliminate that capability until 2015. So I would think that a lot of people in the friend network, regardless of what the initial permissions were, the friend network might not have been okay with that at the time. And I think it's going to take a public outcry, putting pressure on elected officials to set some rules of the road here.
Before we wrap up, Brendan, what do you see as the next step in all of this?
Well, if I can make one point, Izzy said that Cambridge Analytica claims that they only use RNC data for their work on the Trump campaign, but that does not mean that Make America Number One, the Mercer-backed super PAC, was not making use of the hack data. So we really don't know the extent to which this stolen data played a role in Trump's election. But certainly in terms of next steps, we would hope that something like the Honest Ads Act would gain some traction in Congress. At a minimum, there should be a hearing for the Honest Ads Act. Representatives of Facebook should come and testify, and there should be much more discussion about this issue.
Attorney Brendan Fisher with the Campaign Legal Center. Brendan, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Jen Greigel of the Syracuse Newhouse School of Public Communications. Thank you, Jen.
Thank you.
Izzy Lepowski, senior writer for Wired. Izzy, thank you.
Thank you.
And Michael Simon, CEO of Elucid. Thank you, Michael.
A pleasure.
Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you for listening. This is 1A.